When police describe you as a killing machine or compare you to Ted Bundy, you know that at some point you may have gone down the wrong path in life. Just how could an individual be so charming to lure so many girls to him, only to later take their lives? So cunning to be a contestant on the dating game during his spree? Today, we hear the true story of Rodney Elkela.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Rodney James Elkela is an American convicted rapist and serial killer who was sentenced to death in California for 5 murders committed in that state between 1977 and 1979, and received an additional sentence of 25 years to life after pleading guilty to 2 homicides committed in New York in 1971 and 1977. Elkela's true victim count remains unknown and could be much higher. Elkela's compiled a collection of more than 1,000 photographs of women and teenage girls, mainly in sexual explicit poses. In 2016, he was charged with the 1977 murder of a woman identified in one of his photos. Elkela is known to have assaulted one other photographic subject, and police have speculated that others could be rape or murder victims as well. Prosecutors have said that Elkela toyed with his victims, strangling them until they lost consciousness, then waiting until they revived, sometimes repeating this process several times before finally killing them. One police detective described Elkela as a killing machine. Others have compared him to Ted Bundy. Elkela is sometimes called the dating game killer because of his 1978 appearance on the television show The Dating Game, in the midst of his murder spree. So this is a guy that you see him in real life, and I actually earlier today watched the Dating Game clip that he was on. And I have to say, you know, we've talked about so many murderers and horrible people on this show, and you look at a lot of them, and there's something off. You kind of feel creeped out. You kind of feel like there's something, you know, there's just something. Honestly, you know, obviously I'm not a female in 1978, but I would think that this guy was probably pretty popular and looked pretty normal and had a certain appeal to him of the time that would make people feel comfortable. He did not, you know, from what I saw on television, If somebody said to me, you know, of these 3 contestants on today's episode of The Dating Game, who's the serial murderer and rapist, I probably would not have picked him. He just, you know, really had that kind of vibe that didn't give off, you know, creepy killer. But very interesting story that we're going to dig into today. Tony and Carol Hughes joining you on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. And you suggested this one for today's episode. Why is that?
I had read about him mm-hmm. and heard about him like a couple different ways,
yeah,
just out of the blue. And I'm like, how have I never heard about this person before? So I did a little bit of reading about him and stuff. And he is creepily fascinating. And I mean, darkly. And I don't mean that in a flattering way.
Sure.
But like the Dating Game appearance, just the fact that he was on the Dating Game, and he was a pretty good looking dude.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I heard, like, even the girl who picked him was totally creeped out by him afterwards.
Really?
They never went on the date. Because
wow.
So it was everything, like, once he got in front of the camera, he turned it on
because
he was out to win. And even the other contestants were like, this guy's an asshole, you know? And, but, But I think his whole life, because he was a pretty good looking guy and had a certain sense of charm about him,
yeah,
which probably is the Ted Bundy comparison.
Sure.
That people gave him a pass because he's a pretty good looking dude.
And at most, they just wrote him off as being kind of an egotistical asshole.
Right.
Not a serial rapist.
Yeah. And he got away with stuff for a long time. And even when he got caught, he still basically got away with it.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know a ton about this case other than the little bit that we've talked about it. So I'm interested to dig into this and learn about how he just kept going, even though getting caught for this, getting caught for that. And it's right. One of those stories, from what I suspect, it's one of those, oh my God, we're going to be frustrated with the system, quote unquote, by the time we're done with this story. But, you know.
And I think there's certain people who have a certain amount of charm,
mm-hmm.
but and he was probably a pretty smart guy, but I think they have a good way of talking their way out of things too,
mm-hmm.
and getting people to go with them. And I think he used that on a lot of people.
Yeah. Let's dive deeper into the story of Rodney Alcala. We'll go into his early life first here on the dark side of Wikipedia today. Rodney Alcala was born Rodrigo Jaquez Alcala in San Antonio, Texas, to Raul Alcala and Ana Maria Gutierrez. Alcala's father moved the family to Mexico, then abandoned them 3 years later. In 1954, when Alcala was about 11 years old, his mother moved him and his siblings to suburban Los Angeles. In 1960, at age of 17, Alcala joined the United States Army and served as a clerk. In 1964, after what was described as a nervous breakdown, during which he went AWOL and hitchhiked from Fort Bragg to his mother's house, he was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder by a military psychiatrist and discharged on medical grounds. Other diagnoses later proposed by various psychiatric experts at the trials included narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, and from homicide expert Vernon J. Gerbeth, malignant narcissistic personality disorder with psychopathy and sexual sadism traits. After leaving the Army, Alcala graduated from the UCLA School of Fine Arts and later studied film under Roman Polanski at New York University. Alcala committed his first known crime in 1968. A motorist in Los Angeles called police after watching him lure an 8-year-old girl named Tally Shapiro into his Hollywood apartment. The girl was found alive, raped and beaten with a steel bar, but Alcala had fled. To evade the resulting arrest warrant, Alcala left the state and enrolled in the NYU Film School using the name John Berger. In 1971, he obtained a counseling job at the New Hampshire Arts Camp for Children using a slightly different alias, John Berger, spelled slightly differently. In June 1971, Cornciella Michael Crilly, a 23-year-old TWA flight attendant, was found raped and strangled in her Manhattan apartment. Her murder remained unsolved until 2011. The FBI added Alcala to its list of 10 most wanted fugitives in early 1971. A few months later, two children attending the arts camp noticed his photo on an FBI poster at the post office. Alcala was arrested and extradited to California. By then, Shapiro's parents had relocated their entire family to Mexico and refused to allow her to testify at Alcala's trial. Unable to convict him of rape and attempted murder without their primary witness, prosecutors were forced to permit Alcala to plead guilty to a lesser charge of assault. Alcala was paroled after 17 months in 1974 under intermediate sentencing, a program popular at the time which allowed parole boards to release offenders as soon as they demonstrated evidence of rehabilitation. Less than 2 months after his release, he was rearrested after assaulting a 13-year-old girl identified in court records as Julie J., who had accepted what she thought would be a ride to school. Once again, he was paroled after serving 2 years of an intermediate sentence. In 1977, after Alcala's second release, his Los Angeles parole officer took the unusual step of permitting a repeat offender and known flight risk to travel to New York City. NYPD cold case investigators now believe that a week after arriving in Manhattan, Alcala killed Ellen Jane Hoover, 23, daughter of the owner of a popular Hollywood nightclub, Ciro's, and goddaughter of Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. Her remains were found buried on the grounds of the Rockefeller Estate in Westchester County. In 1978, Alcala worked for a short time at the Los Angeles Times as a typesetter and was interviewed by members of the Hillside Strangler Task Force as part of their investigation of known sex offenders. Although Alcala was ruled out as the Hillside Strangler, he was arrested and served a brief sentence for marijuana possession. During this period, Alcala convinced hundreds of young men and women that he was a professional fashion photographer and photographed them for his portfolio. A Times co-worker later recalled that Alcala shared his photos with workmates. "I thought it was weird, but I was young. I didn't know anything," she said. When I asked why he took the photos, he said their moms asked him to. "I remember the girls were naked." He said he was a professional, so in my mind, I was being a model for him. He said a woman who allowed Alcala to photograph her in 1979. The portfolio also included spread after spread of naked teenage boys. She said, "Most of the photos are sexually explicit and most remain unidentified." Police fear that some of the subjects may be additional cold case victims. According to later trial testimony, Alcala knocked unconscious and raped 15-year-old Monique Hoyt while she was posing for photographs. Then in 1978, Alcala was a contestant on the popular game show, The Dating Game. Host Jim Lang introduced him as a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. Between takes, you might find him skydiving or motorcycling. A fellow Bachelor contestant later described Alcala as a very strange guy with bizarre opinions. Alcala won the competition, and the date with Bachelorette Cheryl Bradshaw, who subsequently refused to go out with him because she found him creepy. Criminal profiler Pat Brown, noting that Alcala killed at least three women after his Dating Game appearance, speculated that this rejection might have been an exacerbating factor. "One wonders what that did in his mind." Brown said that is something he would not take too well. Serial killers don't understand the rejection. They think that something is wrong with that girl. She played me. She played hard to get. Samso, murder and the first two trials is our next chapter in just a moment on the dark side of Wikipedia. So very interesting to hear what he had been able to do, be arrested for on the record. It's out there. And still, well, and the Dating that, Game producer said, come victim, on.
That victim, Tally, he picked her up while she's, you know, he's convinced her that he can give her a ride to school. He knows her parents or whatever.
Yeah.
And she was found in his apartment, and he almost killed her. Like, it was horrific. And they know that's his apartment.
Yeah.
And he gets away, escapes, and all that stuff. But then they can't give him, what did they give him, like 2-year sentence for that? Because her parents wouldn't, I mean, I get why you wouldn't have your child want to testify with their attacker right there and bring all that back up again.
Well, especially if it's a couple years later and you've tried to move on as best you can and help the daughter move on. And it suddenly it's back. It's like, why are, you know, it's not worth it for them to go through it again. And for what?
And back then they didn't have DNA. So now with the DNA matching, it might have been different, but it's so crazy to me that all of the things that would prevent someone like him are in place now, like a Dating Game appearance. Do you know how intense that screening would be to get on a show like that now? I don't know. I've never been on one, but You would have to go through some serious screening. They would do a background check.
It makes you wonder.
Even getting the job at the newspaper, they would do a background check on you.
I think it's things like this. It's cases like this that's why HR, that's why producers, that's why all of those things I think are in place, because
absolutely,
there's so many years where shit like this just didn't get vetted. And then, oh my God, look, we had the convicted child rapist on the dating game.
Yeah.
And I mean, had that happened today on an active television show, that show'd be off the fucking air. It would be done.
Yeah.
It would be like, but you did what? Yeah.
He applied. They saw his picture and they're like, he's a good looking guy. Let's put him on.
That's all it was. Yeah. I mean, could you imagine if like The Bachelor or somebody, it's like, oh, by the way, when he's not out raping children and photographing them in his apartment, he's taking long walks on the beach and listening to Mozart. No,
but that's just that narcissistic personality disorder, whatever they said.
Yeah.
The one was narcissistic psychosis or I don't remember. There's a couple different diagnoses at the beginning of that story. But how bold of him, you know, like he doesn't even care.
No, they don't feel shame.
People. I've raped children. I've strangled him. I've taken all these sexually explicit photos of kids. I'm going to try out for the dating game. Like, he doesn't even think about that.
No, they don't. They don't feel shame for their past things at all. And that's the scary part with those disorders, is you can never truly get through to someone who has those disorders. You can point out this was not socially acceptable, obviously beyond that with what the fuck he was doing. But if you're talking about someone who maybe wasn't raping and killing children or whatever it may be, someone who's maybe doing lesser than that, no matter what it is, you know, being hurtful, being cruel, being, you can still never get through to them. And there's no cure for those personality disorders as well. And that's one of the most disheartening things. And we've dealt with that in our lives. And it's such a confusing thing, because you're like, how on earth do you salvage this? Can you salvage this? And in many cases, the answer is simply no, you can't.
And I don't think, in a case like that too, like in his case in particular, because when you're good looking on top of it, people treat you differently.
Yeah.
And you do get attention from women or other men, whatever you're into. And I think that he'd probably been treated differently and felt entitled.
Yeah.
So that combined with him being an extreme narcissist ends up in this weird, like, I can do whatever I want sort of feeling. Like he's entitled to it all.
Yeah, it's a world of power, and it's a world of never feeling consequences for your actions until you go too far and finally get caught. But even then, he got caught so many times and still got out. It's like eventually
17 months for something like attempted murder
of a child. Yeah. I just can't fathom it. But I mean, today, I guess, you know, we still see some of these things in high profile ways with cases like, I mean, like Harvey Weinstein, R. Kelly and things of that nature, where it's like, how long and how much evidence do we fucking need here to be like,
and in
what?
That case, the girl, and it's interesting, because I do believe the guy who saw him abduct Tally comes back again. But he thought that was really strange. Like, wait, that doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah.
And the only reason he was caught then was just some guy in a car going, that didn't look right to me, and followed him and called the cops. Obviously the little girl would have been dead.
Sure. And that's it.
Because someone went with her gut.
And that's, you know, I think so many times people don't go with their gut because they don't want to get involved. They don't want to feel, you know, sometimes just those anonymous calls. And I've done them before where
it's
like,
there's some of that in this story.
Yeah.
To come.
Where you just got to be like, look, I don't want to be on the record, but you got to send somebody out to look at this.
Yeah.
Maybe it's nothing, you know, and if it's nothing, it'll check out just fine. And it's just somebody's weird uncle or something that drives a weird beater van or whatever it may be, you know, but there's times where you just kind of got to be the responsible adult and go, this just feels off, and I don't know why. And sometimes those strike you at inconvenient times, but you could end up saving someone's life for just going with the gut. In worst case, things check out and nothing happens. Unfortunately, sometimes things check out and shit still does happen because there's no record of the person. But let's continue on with this very dark story. The dark side of Wikipedia. Robin Samso, a 12-year-old girl from Huntington Beach, disappeared somewhere between the beach and her ballet class on June 20th, 1979. Her decomposing body was found 12 days later in the Los Angeles foothills. Samso's friends told police that a stranger had approached them on the beach asking to take their pictures. Detectives circulated a sketch of the photographer, and Alcala's parole officer recognized him. During a search of Alcala's mother's house in Monterey Park, police found a rental receipt for a storage locker in Seattle. In the locker, they found Samso's earrings. Alcala was arrested in late 1979 and held without bail. In 1980, he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for Samso's murder. But the verdict was overturned by the California Supreme Court because jurors had been improperly informed of his prior sex crimes. In 1986, after a second trial virtually identical to the first, except for omission of the prior criminal record testimony, he was again convicted and sentenced to death. A Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals panel nullified the second conviction, in part because a witness was not allowed to support Alcala's contention that the park ranger who found Samso's body had been hypnotized by police investigators. While preparing their third prosecution in 2003, Orange County, California investigators learned that Alcala's DNA, sampled under a new state law over his objections, matched semen left at the rape-murder scenes of two women in Los Angeles. Additional evidence, including another cold case DNA match in 2004, led to Alcala's indictment for the murders of four additional women. Jill Barcombe, 18, a New York runway found rolled up like a ball in a Los Angeles ravine in 1977, and originally thought to have been a victim of the Hillside Strangler. Georgia Wickstead, 27, bludgeoned in her Malibu apartment in 1977. Charlotte Lamb, 31, raped, strangled, and left in the laundry room of an El Segundo apartment complex in 1978. Jill Parentatu, 21, killed in her Burbank apartment in 1979. All of the bodies were found posed in carefully chosen positions. Another pair of earrings found in Alcala's Seattle storage locker had residue that matched Lamb's DNA. During his incarceration between the second and third trials, Alcala wrote and self-published a book, You, the Jury, in which he claimed innocence in the Samso case and suggested a different suspect. He also filed two lawsuits against the California penal system for a slip and fall incident and for refusing to provide him a low-fat diet. In 2003, prosecutors entered a motion to join the Samso charges with those of the four newly discovered victims. Alcala's attorney contested it as one of them explained, "If you're a juror and you hear one murder case, you may be able to have reasonable doubt, but it's very hard to say you have reasonable doubt on all five, especially when four of the five aren't alleged by eyewitnesses but are proven by DNA matches." In 2006, the California Supreme Court ruled in the prosecution's favor, and in February 2010, Alcala stood trial in five joint charges. For the third trial, Alcala elected to act as his own attorney. He took the stand in his own defense and for 5 hours played the roles of both interrogator and witness, asking himself questions, addressing himself as Mr. Alcala in a deeper than normal voice, and then answering them. During this bizarre self-question and answering session, he told jurors, often in a rambling monotone, that he was at Knott's Berry Farm applying for a job as a photographer at the time Samso was kidnapped. He showed the jury a portion of his 1978 appearance on The Dating Game, an attempt to prove that the earrings found in his Seattle locker were his, not Samso's. Jed Mills, the actor who competed against Alcala on the show, told a reporter that earrings were not yet a socially acceptable accoutrement for men in 1978. I'd never seen a man with an earring in his ear, he said. I would have noticed them on him. Alcala made no significant attempt to dispute the four added charges, other than to assert that he could not remember killing any of the women. As part of his closing argument, he played the Arlo Guthrie song, Alice's Restaurant, in which the protagonist tells a psychiatrist he wants to kill. After less than 2 days' deliberation, the jury convicted him on all five counts of first-degree murder. A surprise witness during the penalty phase of the trial was Tally Shapiro, Alcala's first known victim. Richard Rappaport, a psychiatrist paid by Alcala and the only defense witness, testified that borderline personality disorder could explain Alcala's claim that he had no memory of committing the murders. The prosecutor argued that Alcala was a sexual predator who knew what he was doing was wrong and didn't care. In March of 2010, Alcala was sentenced to death for a third time. It's pretty crazy that you can get sentenced to death three times in a row.
Yeah, because he just works the system.
Yeah. And the system is set up to work that way.
Himself, which would be so insulting if you are one of the victim's family members sitting there and you have to listen to that crap.
Yeah.
I mean, and that he's only doing that for himself.
It's part of the narcissism.
And what I heard, like, the whole dating game thing was, look, because I was wearing earrings and this proves it. And it never did prove anything. He had long hair, but you couldn't see if he was wearing earrings or not. So none of it. But, you know, I guess you have to allow him to represent himself. But it's just so unfair to the victims' families.
It's insane. It's utterly insane that this is how our system works. I mean, this is 2010 where some of these trials
are. Because then that's your next ground for appeal. Mm-hmm. Because I had incompetent representation. Mm-hmm. Because I was able to represent myself and I don't know nothing about this. And you could appeal on those grounds because you were incompetent.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
It is. This is just a case where it's like, did it really need to go this crazy? Did the grown-ups in the room, was there truly no other way they could have stopped the insanity of him working the system the way that he did? And maybe not.
Well, maybe just lock him up after the first time they caught him.
Yeah, first time you catch someone doing that shit to a kid, and it's like, I'm sorry, you never get out now. Period. You're done. You've been convicted. You're guilty. We're done with you. It's just, you know, it's just over. And I'd have no problem with that shit. Where it's just much stricter sentencing for people doing shit like that to kids. Period.
And there was just a lot of people who came out in the trials from what I heard. And they were like, yeah, he did that to me. I didn't die. Or he attempted to pick me up with that same line.
Yeah.
So there was a pattern you could have so easily established.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. And I kind of...
Not that I'm a lawyer or anything like that. But.
Well, it doesn't take a lawyer to look at this shit and go, oh my God. Like,
not right.
This is completely insane of how long this got used for. Let's go to our next chapter in the story. It starts to dive into the unidentified photographs. In March of 2010, the Huntington Beach, California, and New York City police departments released 120 of Alcala's photographs and sought the public's help in identifying them, in the hope of determining if any of the women and children he photographed were additional victims. Approximately 900 additional photos could not be made public, police said, because they were too sexually explicit. In the first few weeks, police reported that approximately 21 women had come forward to identify themselves, and at least six families said they believed they recognized loved ones who disappeared years ago and were never found. None of the photos were unequivocally connected to a missing person case or unsolved murder, until 2013 when a family member recognized the photo of Christy Thornton, 28, whose body was found in Wyoming in 1982. As of September 2019, 109 of the original photos remain posted online, and police continue to solicit the public's help with further identifications. After his 2010 conviction, New York authorities announced that they would no longer pursue Alcala because of his status as a convict awaiting execution. Nevertheless, in January of 2011, a Manhattan grand jury indicted him for the murders of Cornella Crilly, the TWA flight attendant, and Ellen Hoover, the Ciro's heiress, in 1971 and 1977, respectively. In June of 2012, he was extradited to New York, where he initially entered not guilty pleas on both counts. In December 2012, he changed both pleas to guilty, citing a desire to return to California to pursue appeals of his death penalty conviction. On January 7th of 2013, a Manhattan judge sentenced Alcala to an additional 25 years to life. The death penalty has not been an option in New York State since 2007. In 2010, Seattle police named Alcala as a person of interest in the unsolved murders of Antoinette Whitaker, 13, in July 1977, and Joyce Gaunt, 17, in February of 1978. Alcala rented the Seattle area storage locker, in which investigators later found jewelry belonging to two of his California victims in 1979. Other cold cases were reportedly targeted for reinvestigation in California, New York, New Hampshire, and Arizona. In March of 2011, investigators in Marin County, California, north of San Francisco, announced that they were confident that Alcala was responsible for the 1977 murder of 19-year-old Pamela Jean Lamson, who disappeared after making a trip to Fisherman's Wharf to meet a man who had offered to photograph her. Her battered, naked body was subsequently found in Marin County near a hiking trail with no fingerprints or usable DNA. Charges are unlikely to be filed, but police claim that there is sufficient evidence to convince them that Alcala committed the crimes. Also, in September of 2016, Alcala was charged with the murder of 28-year-old Christine Ruth Thornton, who disappeared in 1977. In 2013, a relative recognized her as the subject of one of Alcala's photos made public by Huntington Beach PD and the New York PD. Her body was found in Sweetwater County, Wyoming in 1982, but was not identified until 2015 when DNA supplied by Thornton's relatives matched tissue samples from her remains. Alcala admitted taking the photo, but not to killing the woman, who was approximately 6 months pregnant at the time of her death. Thornton is the first alleged murder victim linked to Alcala's photos made public in 2010. The 73-year-old Alcala was reportedly too ill to make the journey from California to Wyoming to stand trial on the new charges. He remains in California State Prison. Cochran, pending further appeals of his sentences. So, it's one of those things where he never did get the death penalty.
Which is so ridiculous.
I know. And you just kind of go, how do you do this? How do you work? It's essentially he's creating a template for future killers of, well, if you go out on all this spree and here's how you work the system to never get killed. If you can handle prison for the rest of your life, here's what you can go out and do. And here's how to avoid ever getting the death penalty. And it's
but see,
just
he worked the system the entire time. Because way back in the beginning of the story, and it might have been the Tally one or the girl after.
Yeah.
But you have to go and talk to the prison psychiatrist or whoever. And he convinced him.
Yeah.
He convinced him. He's perfectly fine. He told them what they wanted to hear and they let him out. And that's what he did his whole life. Just whatever it took to and that's how he got all these victims too. He convinced them that he was a photographer and played to their vanity, like, you're so beautiful. And what 13 or 15-year-old girl doesn't want to hear that?
My daughter would be like, fuck you, get away from me, and scream. But that's the thing. I mean, it's one of those things where that's not everybody. And you don't want to expose your children to a world of this being a reality, but we live in a world of this being a reality, and people need to be prepared for it. You know, maybe it's overreacting. Maybe the odds are not great that someone could fall into, you know, the hands of someone like this. But God damn it, I'd rather, you know, have them be aware of what can be out there without having to read the whole Wikipedia entry to them. But at least being prepared that, you know, there's shitty people out there and they do horrible things to people. And don't believe me, here's all the shit that's been, you know, done to
people. But, you know, in the 70s, it was much different. Like, and I think one of the victims, and it's not really talked about in that story, like she was hitchhiking. She was 15. Mm-hmm. Well, girls would do that.
Yeah.
Like, my God, if I saw a 15-year-old girl hitchhiking now, I would have to pull over and have a talk with her.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
And that, to me, baffles me. I mean, I wasn't around at that time to see that world where that was going on like that. But, I mean, what it was just, what, safer, quote unquote? I mean, clearly not with what was happening. But it was just viewed socially as safer?
Yeah. I mean, but I also, I don't know. I think there's always been, obviously, creepy people like him around.
Yeah.
But it just maybe didn't get reported on as much. It just didn't seem like that dangerous. I'd never done anything like that. Like,
sure.
I don't know anybody who hitchhiked before my time. But I think like in the 60s and stuff, people, that wasn't an issue for them. They're very trusting. And the world is a much darker place in some ways.
Is it a darker place? Or is it just that people could get away with shit a lot easier, so we never found out about so many things? How many people were doing horrible, horrible shit and ended up living out their lives as, you know, dad and grandpa, and they had this other personality side and they stopped doing what they were doing, but there's all these cold case missing files from the 60s and 70s, there's just no way to solve them. But who were the killers? They were the people among us that we thought were not killers. And that's what I wonder about. Is it truly darker? Do we just know more about this to catch people better? And then that makes it look worse.
I think we know more.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the media is different.
Yeah.
We didn't all have small little computers we carried with us everywhere.
Sure.
And access to everything 24/7. You know, the TV went off at a certain time at night back then.
Yeah.
You had like three channels to watch. So I think, and there's no DNA. So I think it was easier to get away from things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they couldn't track your cell phone or where it's pinging. And so I think that's been, I think with technology, they've been able to catch people.
Yeah.
Because that guy got away with a lot of shit. Like, the students at that camp literally go to the post office and see his most wanted sign hanging there.
It's like, hey, that's so-and-so.
Yeah, and they went back and reported it in the story I read. They went back and reported it to one of their teachers, another person at this camp.
Yeah.
And he went and looked at it. And he's like, I think they're right.
Do we see as many cases today like this where it's unsolved for so long and people get away? I mean, I don't think that we do. I feel like they're able to catch people a lot easier and a lot faster than even into the 80s. You know, I think things have progressed. I'm sure there's some out there, but I feel like things have gotten better. I remember when I was a kid, and I think an unspoken thing about all of these cases that we have are the people that were surrounding these individuals, whether it be friends, whether it be family, whether it be acquaintance,
and in his case, his mother, she really stood up for him.
Yeah. I mean, I think the people, and I'm more so talking about like the victims, friends, family, acquaintances, the psychological impact that has on people for the rest of their lives of knowing, oh my God, you feel like, could this happen to me? I personally have a story that I still kind of work with on it, because I think it's affected me for my entire life. When I was a kid, there was a woman that was abducted at the mall that my mom worked at. And it was This woman also was a waitress at a restaurant that we frequented. So I actually remember seeing her. It's Wisconsin. I remember her bringing cheese curds to the table and visiting with us a little bit every now and then because we go to the restaurant semi-frequently. And then she just disappeared from the mall one day. And I don't know if they've ever solved this case or not, quite honestly. For the whole time I lived there, for the next however many years, 10, 15 years, it was unsolved. But as a kid, I was probably about 7 or 8 when this happened. I don't know, maybe a little bit older, but in that area. It was my first like kind of memory of my anxiety really going fucking nuts. And I was so afraid and so nervous every time my mom would go to work because she had to walk out of JCPenney at late at night and go out to her car. And I became very possessive of her, of like, please be careful, please be safe. And you know, she would say, yes, you know, I will, you know, don't worry. It was always met with, don't worry, Tony, don't worry, Tony. Not like, maybe we should get you to talk to somebody and work through this. And at the
and
time-
you were an only child. I know. On top of that, it's like-
yeah. And at the time it was, you know, that wasn't as open of an option as it is today, quite honestly. So we got to look at the perspective of it. They weren't being assholes or neglective parents. I don't believe that at all. But it was just, you know, putting your kid into therapy at the time, I think really meant there's something wrong with your kid. And there probably was. I think, you know, that's where they could have looked early on at me and going, yeah, your Asperger's is shit. And you have, you know, all these other things that make you worry about things. But, you know, it would have been nice to be able to kind of deal with some of those things at a younger age as opposed to 37 and now talking to my therapist about these things. But,
hey, but at least you got the therapist now.
Now I do.
Better
yeah.
late than ever.
But there's a lot of these things. And there was another kid at that time, too, who was because the other woman was in her 20s. There was another little girl that was riding her bike out in the country, something I did all the fucking time. And then just abducted, missing. I don't know that one's ever been solved either. And they were almost like back to back. I think it was like the same summer. And it was like a summer that I look back on and I go, shit, you know, I think that was a bit of trauma for me, even though like I didn't know her. But, you know, that sort of stuff, if you're the right kid that pays attention to those sort of things, it affects you. And I think there's a lot of these with all these cases. There's a lot of people that, you know, still to this day deal with the trauma of these sort of things and try to work through them. But yeah, I mean, I'm an open book about all this shit, so I don't care. I mean, I think it's important to be open in how we feel, but it's just crazy. You know, how some of these things had been handled and how are they being handled now? So we don't repeat the patterns of the past. But there you go. Very dark story there of Rodney and his, if you want to find his dating game appearance, it is on YouTube in case you'd like to relive that magic. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Send me a screenshot of it. Send it to review@darksideofwiki. You'll be entered in to win a $200 Amazon gift card. We'll be giving that away very soon for your review. One person will get that. So please do leave that. That helps us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that this program exists. Until next time, for The Dark Side of Wikipedia and for Carol, I'm Tony Brewski. Thank you for listening.